there's historical romance that just have only the vaguest relationship to the actual history of Britain. And there's historical romance that gets really down and dirty into it and where the author has really delved into it. And although I prefer the second kind, but I don't think the first kind should be dismissed because it is doing something else. I don't think every historical romance needs to go, there was only 28 dukes and most of them had syphilis and no teeth and everyone's got lice. I don't want to read books where everyone's got lice, you know. If I want lice, I'll have young children again. I would rather read a book where they just sort of throw their hands up and just go, okay, we're hairing the hell out of this, you know, because actually, Georgia Hare, although she did loads of research and everything, when she actually did the bits that are really historically grounded, which is to say An Infamous Army and the other readers, they're awful, they're so boring, they're dreadful. Nobody reads them, nobody wants to read them. The sort of glittery, bally, wonderful, wonderful romancy ones. We love them. And it is good that people do that. And I think there is space for both. But this is actually something I'm struggling with at the moment because, like a fool, I've been trying to write a Duke book. I mean, fundamentally, my problem is, and this really does cut quite deep into the fact that I write historical romance, is that I sort of feel like the entire aristocracy should have been executed.
That was the voice of K.J. Charles, an author who helped establish a place for queer historical romance in the modern genre, writing, as she describes her work, hair but gayer. In this Trailblazer episode, we talk about K.J.'s writing, about the way she views the historical romance genre, about building communities of queer people on page, and about her work as a romance editor back in the day for Mills and Boon. You're listening to Fated Mates. I'm Sarah McLean. I read romance novels and I write them.
And I'm Jennifer Prokop, a romance reader and editor, although I don't want to call myself that today because K.J. Charles was a real romance editor. And I'm just like going to like be like, okay, well, I...
You know, listen, you just have 19 more years to go.
Hire me, Mills and Boon, so I can feel real.
Oh my God, imagine what a good job. Ugh, what a fun job.
Just editing presents all the time. The dream.
The literal dream, yes.
Anyway, but before we get there, we have something else. We have a little housekeeping for everyone. In case you didn't download our quick 6-minute episode last week, Fated Mates Live is happening in person in Brooklyn, New York, the best borough of New York City.
Obviously.
March 24th at 7 p.m. We suggest you call up all your romance-loving friends and make a weekend of it. The 24th is a Friday. March is a great time to come to New York City because it's, you know, maybe a little gray, but not super cold. And it'll be very fun. You can go to a museum. You can go to a show. You can come see us. The ticket include a gift certificate to the Romance Book Table, sponsored by Word Bookstores in Brooklyn. There will be a bar. There will be lots of other Fated Mates listeners to make friends with. And Jen and me, and a really delightful spate of special guests, many of whom you all know already.
It's been really exciting to see people on Instagram and Twitter talking about, like, getting their friends together and buying tickets and arranging to come into the city for the weekends.
Put on a mask, get on an airplane or a train, and come see us. FatedMates.net/live.
And now that that's off the table, without further ado, here is our conversation with K.J. Charles.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. I'm so excited. I don't think we've ever met, so...
Not in person. I think we've been on panels, but this is a proper face-to-face,
yeah,
so that's nice.
It's great. So it's nice to meet you. It's nice to see your face.
Yes, you too.
So everybody, as we've mentioned, I'm really excited about our conversation today because I have also hosted a few panels with KJ, and I love listening to you talk about romance. And I'm really excited because you are also an editor, which is, you know, a personal interest to me. Not that it's about me, everybody. So we are really excited to have you today on as a Trailblazer. And really, one of our first questions, just because we love hearing about it, is what was your journey to romance?
Well, my mother had a complete set of Georgette Hares, which is basically, you know, you do.
That'll do it.
yeah, I'm an immensely fast reader and a voracious one. I always have been. So, you know, when I was a kid, so just sat in the library all summer and, you know, I read extremely quickly. So I was ploughing through all of my parents' books. So I had to remove all the inappropriate ones from the shelves kind of thing. And so, yes, I'd read through the entirety of Georgette Heyer and, you know, obviously formative. I was thinking about it and basically Cotillion and These Old Chains pretty much sum up the two strands of my writing. You know, Cotillion, you've got Freddie, who is this wonderfully, he's not, you know, not too bright, wonderful, generous heart, immensely kind, and also the superpower of really, really good manners to be deployed, like, accurately. And then you've got Avon in These Old Chains, who's basically just a complete amoral son of a so-and-so. So, yeah, and those two basically sum up most of my writing. Although it is, I was also reflecting that Georgette Heyer, for her era, and with the proviso of the kind of person she was and the many prejudices she had, but there's an awful lot of queerness in Georgette Heyer's historical romances. You know, in The Reluctant Widow, the actual hero, who isn't the guy who marries the heroine, is, you know, very, very heavily queer-coded. In The Corinthian, you've got the heroine who is masquerading as a boy, and the fact that the bad guy effectively hints that he's going to blackmail the hero for having taken off the boy in a private, et cetera, et cetera. So there's very much, very strong awareness of non-conventional sexuality. And then The Masquerade is just the most ridiculous cross-dressing, gender-bending, you know. So there's a lot of that in here. So, yeah, it's formative, definitely. And then I kind of didn't follow up my intro. I was more of a fantasy reader, to be honest. But when I was, about 28 or so, and an editor, I got a job at Mills & Boon, which, to be honest, I took because I was working at an absolutely disastrous company for a lunatic and I needed to get out of there. And Mills & Boon happened to be advertising.
Take the rope that comes.
It was very much take the rope that comes. You know, I wanted a job that would mean not having to go into that snake pit, and they wanted an editor. And I stayed there for years, and I, you know, everything I learned about editing really came from there.
When you started at Mills & Boon, aside from Heyer, did you have any frame of reference for what was going on in romance?
Not really, no. I haven't been reading any romance at all. Well, the thing is, because of being an editor, I actually mostly concentrated on reading what I was working on. So when I worked at a travel guide company, I would be reading nonfiction or, you know, fiction, but set in the country for the travel guide I was working on. And then I moved to a house that was doing politics and history, which I read an awful lot of that. So I wasn't actually reading romance at that time. So Mills & Boon came as a complete change of track. But, you know, it was just so much more fun. So much more fun.
What did you begin with at Mills & Boon?
They plunge you right into it. So basically, I was on the medical team, the medical romance team.
And we haven't talked a ton about medical romances on the podcast. So,
oh, see, I love that.
It's a very English world, the medical romance.
A lot of our top authors were Australians.
They seem Australian to me more
than...
Yeah,
well, no, it pretty much divided English-Australia. I can't offhand think of American, in fact.
I did not grow up with medical romances. And, I mean, I read all of them.
They were not the big one, but it was a good team. I like working on it.
Listen, Sarah, we grew up with George Clooney on ER, though. I know.
Well, yeah.
I mean, that's not to say that I don't love a doctor romance, and that's a separate episode.
But we had some fabulous. So we had Alison Roberts, who was actually a paramedic, wrote such exciting story, like really exciting. She did one which said there was a big earthquake, and then there was four stories set around it. It was a wonderful sort of linked series, all starting from the earthquake.
Sure.
Terrific. So good to work on. And she did another trilogy that basically tracked over the progress of one person's pregnancy, for which I had to do the worst Excel spreadsheet in the world. You know? You had to make sure these three books, every single incident, all tracked to this one pregnancy. Oh, shoot me. But it had Marion Lennox as well, who is a wonderful one. She divided between what we called it tender romance then, which I think is just, what do you call it? Harlequin
like heartwarming?
Romance? Yeah. It was just Harlequin romance.
Just Harlequin
basically
romance.
As opposed to Harlequin Presents.
Uh-huh.
They've probably changed the name about 15 times since then. But Marion Lennox was, I mean, she was my, yeah, one of my favourite authors to work with, but she wrote the And this was kind of quite formative for me because it was a book of hers. I actually looked it up yesterday. It's called Bushfire Bride. And it's one of those, you know, the heroine's got a husband who is in a coma and has been in a coma for 8 years. And there's a sequence where she basically says goodbye to him. And yeah, I'm literally editing this manuscript. This
already.
Is back in the day. Well, this is back in the day when you edited by hand, you know, like you literally had a printout and you made the edits by hand to be input by the copy editor, because that's how old I am. And
me too.
You know, I was literally crying so hard while I was reading this that the copy editor was like, you're going to have to redo this page.
You're tear stained.
Literally tear stained. I mean, God, she absolutely wrung my heart. I can't, in fact, I didn't have to look it up too much. I was thinking, what was that book called? So Bushfire Bride came into my head. And that's 20 years ago, easy 20 years ago. Amazing. So yeah, that was, it was formative because I delved a lot. We did a lot of books. Yeah, the turnover there was absolutely crazy. And I worked, although I was mainly on the medical team, everyone worked across all four. So the historical, Harlequin Presents, medical and tender, that's right. So you worked across them and you got given, and if an editor or author got absolutely sick of one another, you might get them switched in. Plus I was very fast, so people tended to give me an extra manuscript when there was a panic on, which there almost always was, because you know,
sure.
Well, you couldn't have a book come in late because of the nature of the publishing. So, and then if everything did fall apart, you had to delve into the slush pile and actually pull out a finished manuscript and find out a way to make it publishable within the next week.
Amazing.
You learn to edit. I tell you what, you learn to edit like that. It's the most fantastic grounding and structural editing, because you have to be able to pretty much look at a slush pile manuscript and say, okay, you know, it's got totally good bones. The writing's a bit shonky, but if the author will agree to basically let me do a really massive edit on it, this will work. Or alternatively, you know, this isn't working at all, but here is a thing that I can tell the author to do. And if they do it, it will,
yeah,
that will work. But you've got to be able to pretty much x-ray the book and look at the structure and, you know, identify what will work and what won't.
Well, especially because in category, there's no flab. I mean, you don't have any space.
It's all bones and muscle. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really something. So you could, I mean, there was weeks when I did six manuscripts in a week kind of thing, which is insane. But, you know, like I say, you couldn't, if you were publishing eight presents in a month, you can't publish seven presents. It doesn't work like that.
Right.
Eight presents.
Yeah.
That's it.
People have signed up for their box. Right.
Well, exactly. It's completely non-negotiable. So I honestly think it was, I couldn't have had a better training in fiction editorial. It was, you know, because it was so fast and so relentless, but you had to be really super practical.
So at what point during that process did you think, I'm going to start doing this myself? Is that how it went? Or
when I was there, well, you see, I didn't really. I was sort of, I've always had it vaguely in mind that it would be nice to write, or indeed to have written a book. When I was there, they very kindly let me go off for 4 months and work from home in Japan. And, you know, this is, as I say, 20 odd years ago. So that was a really, you know, pretty advanced thing for them to do. My husband was doing, my then boyfriend was doing stuff in Japan, and we lived there for 4 months. So I did use, you know, some of my free time to start writing then, but it wasn't a romance. It was, you know, I wrote a fantasy novel, which has never been published, nor should it be. And then I wrote a thriller, which was picked up by Samhain and sold about 12 copies, probably deservedly. But it didn't occur to me to write a romance at all. I mean, it just never, partly, I think, actually, trying to write a romance while you're working at Mills and Boone might actually be a really, really bad idea. And your head might explode. Or, you know, yeah, I couldn't recommend that, I don't think. So it was quite a long time, actually, after I had left. And then I got married about a year later, and then about a year after that I had a baby, and I started writing when the baby was quite small, because, you know, you're trying to stay sane, and it was supposed to be a fantasy novel, but at that point, with all the years I'd worked with Mills and Boone, basically romance had like
coded
my neural pathways are like valleys, you know, my neural pathways are just carved so deeply into my brain. But it just turned into a romance. And that was The Magpie Lord, which was my first published book, my first romance. And, you know, once I sort of just leaned into it, it just felt like the most natural thing in the world to do it. So there we are.
So it sounds like you mostly edited contemporary romance. So what was the draw for you to historical romance or queer romance? Like, did one of those come first in your brain in terms of the kind of story you wanted to write?
I'm always more interested in historical. The thriller that I wrote was an attempt at contemporary, and, you know, I hated everything about it because I live under a rock and I don't like modern technology, and it dates so badly, so quickly. And, you know, mobile phones ruin everything because you set up this whole drama and someone could literally just phone up and go, oh, yeah, this is what's going on, and you've ruined everything. And then you've got to find a reason for them not to have a mobile.
Yeah.
So, yeah, historical, obviously where it's at. And also I like the differences. You know, I like doing the research and I like writing about different times and different people and different places. And, you know, the similarities and differences are just much more interesting to me. So although I didn't read many, I didn't edit, rather, many historicals at Nelson Boone. Because we only did four a month, and they had a historicals team. So I had like one or two authors. It's always been what I wanted to write. And kind of the other thing is, you know, I'm very pulp focused. A lot of what I write is sort of riffing off the pulp of the Victorian and Edwardian and sort of 1920s period, because I just really enjoy that. I enjoy like picking that up and running with it and messing about with it and often queering it, because as anyone who plays with Victorian to 20th century pulp will tell you, it's just absolutely ripe for that. You know, it's just fun. Right. It's fun.
Yeah. Gosh, it's so fun. I feel like that's the thing I really love about your books is, you know, there was one, and I'm terrible with titles, where he was like a taxidermist. Is that right?
Yes, an unseen attraction.
Yes. And I was seriously like, why am I really interested in this right now? Why is this such a great time?
I loved doing that, but it wasn't actually what it was meant to be. I pitched it to the publisher as something completely different, but then I couldn't write the thing I pitched it to the publisher at. It turned out to be a terrible idea. I can't even remember now why taxidermist struck me as a good idea. But it's one of the most fun books I've ever read. You know, I did this deep dive into Victorian taxidermy. I've got the most extraordinary books on my bookshelf. But, you know, I had a whole sequence where he actually taxidermies a canary, just because it was so fascinating to me. I was about inches, literally inches, from going and finding someone who would teach me to do it myself.
Well, that's the best part about that. You can convince yourself. I always feel like writing historical also gives you, it's really best for procrastinators, because then we can sort of go off and convince ourselves that learning how to taxiderm is actually work.
It's totally.
You had to learn to pick a lock to write that book, Sarah.
I learned to
for
pick
sure.
a lock to write a lock
That's
pick.
So
I mean,
cool.
I mean, it did become very useful when I had to open my mother's like cheap safe.
Okay, that's fantastic.
And I've never felt more powerful.
This week's episode of Faded Mates is sponsored by Kylie Scott, author of End of Story, a new book out this week.
We love Kylie Scott here at Faded Mates, and this one sounds like a banger. Oh, she's so great. So here's the story. Susie Bowen inherits a charming fixer-up from her aunt. And so she is like really excited, like she's going to do the whole HGTV scene and like revamp the whole thing. And
perfect.
The book starts with a knock on her door. Her contractor has arrived. And
is he hot?
He's hot. His name's Lars. That's real hot.
Yes!
Unfortunately, Lars is her ex's best friend.
Oh,
and
Lars.
Her ex is a real dirtbag. And Lars saw their whole humiliating public breakup. And Susie just is like, oh,
no,
God, what am I going to do?
But she needs a contractor.
She does. And Lawrence is available, thank goodness. So I think she's just going to have to lean into it.
Even if it's petty contracting.
It's fine. Whatever. Here's the part that's great. He is tearing down some wall, and they find a divorce certificate hidden in the wall that is dated 10 years in the future and has both of their names.
What?
Right? Like, what's going to happen?
Why? What?
You and Lars and Susie are going to have to discover it all together by downloading and reading this book.
I mean, as though I wasn't going to download and read this book anyway.
Of course.
No matter what it was about, because Kylie's amazing. But this is such a cool idea. I'm going to read it immediately.
Exactly. Have a great time, everybody. You can find End of Story anywhere ebooks are sold, in audio or in print.
Thanks to Kylie for sponsoring the episode. One of the things that Jen and I have been talking about a lot recently, there's a woman who is on TikTok and also Twitter, and her handle is Baskin Sons, and she's been talking a lot about how, in her mind, historical is really more like speculative fiction than it is like historical fiction. Historical romance is more like speculative fiction than historical romance is like historical fiction. And I think this is a really fascinating way of thinking about the genre. And I wonder if how that strikes you.
I think there's very definitely strands of it. Bridgerton, the TV series, for example.
Right.
I mean,
right.
But why not? So there are actually, we could debate this one for hours and people already have, so I'm not going to go into that. But on the face of it, you could look at that and literally just go, okay, this is a fantasy version where, a large number of the aristocracy of people of colour, and why should you not do that? Why is that not a good thing to do? And there's historical romance that just does have only the vaguest relationship to the actual history of Britain. And there's historical romance that gets really down and dirty into it, and where the author has really delved into it. And although I prefer the second kind, but I don't think the first kind should be dismissed, because it is doing something else. But maybe looking at it as the historical fantasy without magic would almost be sort of resolve that argument, if you see what I mean, because it is trying to do something else. I don't think every historical romance needs to go, there was only 28 dukes and most of them had syphilis and no teeth and everyone's got lice. No. I don't want to read books where everyone's got lice. If I want lice, I'll have young children again.
I don't want to read any books where there's any lice, actually.
Yeah, exactly. So, I would rather read a book where they just sort of throw their hands up and just go, okay, we're hairing the hell out of this, because actually Georgia Hare, although she did loads of research and everything, when she actually did the book sort of really historically grounded, which is to say An Infamous Army and the other readers, they're awful. They're so boring. They're dreadful. Nobody reads them. Nobody wants to read them.
No, it's much more fun to read her making things up.
Yeah. Well, the sort of glittery, bally, wonderful, wonderful romancey ones, we love them. And it is good that people do that. But I suspect that's kind of what that person might have been getting at, or at least that's how I feel about it. And I think there is space for both. Very definitely.
Right.
But this is actually something I'm struggling with at the moment, because like a fool, I've been trying to write a Duke book. And my problem with the Duke book, fundamentally my problem is, and this really does cut quite deep into the fact that I write historical romance, is I sort of feel like the entire aristocracy should have been executed. And usually I sort of hand wave this one, and then I started writing a Duke, and I've got 60,000 words, and I'm just sitting there going, you haven't got any problems that cannot be solved by your money, which you have.
Exactly. Money, power, title. Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, seriously, you don't have any problems. So I have not, in fact, squared that circle yet. And if I've wasted 60,000 words, I'm going to be banging my head against a wall. But currently, I feel like I've wasted 60,000 words, because I cannot for the life of me.
It's Poor Little Rich Boy, right?
It is, and that's not something I struggle with. No.
And that's not your brand. He didn't like his dad, KJ.
The things that could be a problem, I will bore you with my struggles, because I'm boring myself with my struggles, but it's a real problem for me.
It's interesting that you bring this up, because I actually think this is a push-pull that's happening. This did not happen in historical romance 20 years ago. Nobody worried
about
this.
Even 10 years ago.
Yeah. Or even 10 years ago. But now, those of us, I've written 1,000 Dukes, right? And you can see it in my writing that I've gone from Poor Little Rich Boy to now it's time to burn down the dukedom entirely, right? Let's set it on fire.
It's really hard not to, isn't it? Because
I don't do it anymore.
Exactly. And you've moved, because apart from anything else, I don't know about you, but how often do you just sit there and think, so where does this guy's money come from?
Oh, well, yeah. And then, and what's interesting is in the 80s or 90s, you could wave it away. He has plantations, but he pays his workers. right?
Or, you know, you don't even mention the plantation. It's just, he's just rich.
Right.
Okay, it's fine. He's rich. He's got land. We don't talk about the English people working for him. Still less the anyone outside, you know, make it Victorian.
Exactly.
And how much of his money is coming from empire, which is, say, colonialism, which is theft.
Right.
Yeah,
there, and there are only so many times that you can sort of accept, well, this one got his title, you know, when he was 35 because he did something good. You know, there's not.
Yeah. And if they do that, you know, steal money, where's
and
that
probably
come from?
In a war. Like, there's a lot. It's hard.
There is a lot. Yeah. there is a lot.
Which is why there's something to this, like, it's, like you said, historical fantasy, you know, but no magic. Because it does feel like, in a lot of ways, the work that these books are doing, the social work that these books are doing is not about, obviously, it's very difficult to handle, like, where did the power come from? Where did the money come from?
Mm.
But in many cases, in your books especially, right, the work of your books is very important currently for the world that we live in now, for 2023. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, about how you think about the job, the work of the books in a world where right now, like, queer people and books about queer people are under attack across the United States and around the world. So, you know, how do you reconcile the work with the world, I guess, is the question.
Oh, lordy.
I'm asking, you know, for a friend who is me.
do you mean in the sense of, yeah, the sort of the guiding principles,
yeah,
as it were? Yeah, I mean, I feel like, fundamentally, the purpose of romance, I mean, it's twofold, isn't it? You want to give hope and you want to give connection. So, you know, the hope is a romance gives us, like, a portrayal of a better world where people are loyal and people are loving and someone stands up for you and you've got your family and, you know, it's just, and you know, it's not just hope, it's fulfilled hope, because you pick up a book thinking, I hope this ends well, and it does, because it's a romance novel. And then I think you've got connection in the sense of, you know, you're writing a book that depicts people connecting in a real way, but also, you know, there's a romance community, and there's the fact that, you know, when people, if people see a romance novel with someone who looks like them or behaves like, you know, a queer person, a black person, whoever on the cover, and that romance novel is being sold and it's on the shelves of the bookshop, that's really, really important. And it's all the more important if they're taking the books out of the schools and the libraries, which I have to say is a barbarism, so terrifying that I, you know, I don't know what your policy on swearing is, but...
No, know, please go for it, word.
I mean, when it comes down to it, I want my books to be ones that people, you know, not... That there are places of safety where things work out, even if things don't look like they're going to work out, which I think is important, because, you know, there is absolutely a place of very, very low angst romance where everything is totally okay, and I don't write that. But you know, I'm really glad it exists, because people sometimes need to go there. But I think people also sometimes need to have, you know, the drama and the angst or whatever, but still with the guarantee of everything being okay, and still with the just... You know, we use fiction to tell ourselves that the world could be a better place, fundamentally.
Mm-hmm.
That is what fiction is for. It's to, you know, try things out and explore them and, you know, say, look, here is this thing. This is the way the world could be. And, you know, I write the books how the world should have been and, you know, how I would like it to be.
Yeah. I think I keep thinking about what we were talking about like the Duke situation, and I think part of the reason class is so hard to deal with in romance is, like, we all know that many people have found happiness even in the throes of financial instability. Like, of course, right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, we all also know that, like, with financial instability does make so many problems go away.
Yeah.
And I think, like, romance really hasn't quite figured out how to, like, grapple with some of that. I mean, and I know that's, like, I'm sorry I'm, like, bringing that back, but I was thinking as you were talking, too, about, like, how the world should be, right? Like, and I think so much of what romance is trying to do when it's like found family and this is the way the world should be is we shouldn't have people that are like, well, I can't really like have the life I want to live right now because I have to work 800 hours a week or whatever. Yeah. I mean, I think, or I can't have the life I want to live because I live in Florida and like these books are being banned. And what's that like for my family or my children? And I think so much of what romance is about is saying we don't have to live like that.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah. It's and I think addressing problems, you know, through a fictional lens is a great way of helping people deal with them. I mean, I remember one absolutely lovely bit of mail I got that was from a reader who was going through something like quite rubbish. I think it might have been chemo. But she basically said that she... This is going to sound kind of... I'm actually, it's going to ring a bell because you're all going to have done it. But she basically was reading this book of mine where the hero is kidnapped and he's basically trapped in this room and he's just doggedly doing sit-ups with a chain on his leg because he's not going to sit there and do nothing. So he does like 1,000 sit-ups. And she's pretty much said, you know, I was just... You know, I was going through it thinking, well, I'm like Darling, yeah, I'm like Will Darling doing his sit-ups. And, you know, if he can do 1,000 sit-ups, then I can do this thing, kind of thing. And actually, that's...
Oh, nice.
It is. Well,
but it's, you know, it's... So it's not just about romance providing an escape, although it does provide an escape. I think, you know, it's... We can all use this. We can all think of characters and almost model yes. ourselves. You know, yeah, this is why people who... Sex positivity is important. Or, you know, depicting sexual relationships at work. I'm not going to necessarily say healthy because, you know, another thing romance does, which is a big matter of discussion, but, you know, you can show people starting from a quite an unhealthy place. But, you know, you can actually show them starting from an unhealthy place and improving. You can show, you can model all sorts of behavior and people can sort of try them out and apply those ideas to their own situation while they're also reading a highly entertaining book that doesn't feel didactic.
Right. Well, and I think for me, it's always been... Like, love is worth it, even when you've been hurt, right? Like, we've all been hurt. I mean, I know it's, like, very old school, but those, like, old 90s romance heroes who are like, I've been hurt once, I can never love again, like, that means something to me because we all have, right? I mean, like, I don't think there's anything more brave than, like, putting your heart on the line again. And I think romance every single time is really saying, like, you know, you might not be called to some big act of bravery in your life, regular people of the world. But you yeah. will be called upon to make these like small commitments to the people in your lives and say like my community or the people. I mean, that, I don't know. I know that's really cheesy maybe, but like that really means something to me.
But, and, I mean, it does. It's just a thing that I get quite a few letters and, you know, people discover the most, yeah, if they really see themselves in a character, if they see a dyspraxic character and they've not read one before and it means something to them to be seen, or, you know, people who read a absolute shedload of queer romance and then they kind of go, actually, you know, it turned out I might not be cishet after all, which happens. So, yeah, it happens, to, you know, and that's some people who've never had the, been aware that there was an option, you know, discover that. I think that is the power of romance. It's the power of showing how things could be and they work out. They yeah. guaranteed work out. You know, they don't do the little life on you.
And I think that to that point, we've really been very lucky as romance readers and people in the community for the last however long decade, because it feels like there was so much less of that representation before. And you know, we've tried really hard for these particular episodes to bring people in who have been working on representation of all forms from, you know, the beginning of the beginnings of the modern genre. But, you know, I think about it was so rare to see characters who were anything other than cishet, white, thin,
yeah,
you know, rich
people,
etc. before, you know, but now it feels like part of the reason why we asked you to join us is because it does feel like when you came onto the scene, there was a shift. Not that you brought the shift
No, but, it's driving away.
But you were a part of something that was happening on, it was firing on all cylinders, right? There's
Zeitgeist.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. So I wonder if you could talk, was there an awareness of that for you as somebody who had come up through, I mean, one of the most classic romance avenues was the sort of Harlequin Mills and Boone pathway, right? So what you were looking, what you were working on when you were there was the almost like the purest of romance?
Very much the old school.
Yeah. And so was there, did you have an awareness at the time that you started writing or you started being published that something was shifting?
It's actually quite interesting because I sold Magpie Lord to Samhain.
Gosh, and Samhain was doing so much of that too.
They were doing a shed load, but even they basically went, look, this is Victorian queer fantasy and Victorian queer fantasy romance, and they pretty much said expect it to sell 12 copies because, you know, it's not Eden Regency, people don't like historical that much, it's got fantasy which can put a bunch of people off, you know.
Sure.
They were doing quite a lot of queer romance, but you were really very much looking at contemporaries, mostly with two bare torsos on the cover kind of thing. And I did actually go out looking. The only other one I could find was Widdershins by Jordan L. Hawke, who was also 19th century.
Sure.
Queer, you know, so same era fantasy. I was like, no, that's exactly the right book. You just here. Yeah, well, how dare you say there isn't one of them? Of course there is.
There's one of them. Yeah.
Yes. Well, that's always the way, isn't it? There can be only one. But, you know, but Jordan self-published. So, you know, my expectations were extraordinarily low, basically. They didn't expect it to sell a lot, but they still wanted to do it. And, you know, although they didn't end well, I really respect what they were doing. And then it did sell well. I mean, you know, it sold extremely well.
Yeah. Do you know why? Do you know how? I mean, obviously, it's fantastic, and that's why. But was there something that happened? Was there somebody who...
There was a Goodreads reader who I don't know if I'm right, but I've always attributed it to this one personal Goodreads. You know how some people on Goodreads have, some of them just seem to have 40 zillion connections?
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of them got an ARC and just left this absolutely phenomenal review. And then it just went boom.
Yeah.
Because it also feels like fantasy, you scooped up a world of readers who... We're not being served by romance at all.
Yeah. And there was, people love, I mean, yeah, look at how much historical fantasy and indeed queer historical fantasy there is now. It's just this is wonderful, wonderful cornucopia because I think everyone's always loved it. I don't know why people, except, you know, one of the most depressing things to me about working with publishers, and I've really experienced this as an editor, is that... They just sit there going, that won't sell. Oh, no, that won't sell. Well, how do you know it won't sell? We haven't published one. Well, somebody else did one and it didn't sell.
We've tried nothing, KJ.
We've tried nothing and we're out of ideas. it is along the lines of, I've heard people say variants on, if it sold, we'd have already published something like it.
Nobody has new ideas.
we'd already know if this kind of thing would sell. There isn't loads of this on the market already, therefore it doesn't sell. And you go, well, why don't we start it? Oh, it is genuinely infuriating. And then you get through that, and then you go through the there can be only one phase,
mm-hmm.
Which we have lived through, in which they will absolutely publish a black author, but one black author.
Right.
You know, we can have one Indian, or, you know, we can have one queer person on our books, but goodness me, not more, because, yeah, one is... plenty, and then oh my god, it doesn't sell because there's just one book,
right? Beverly Jenkins forever.
Yeah, well, but I mean, yeah, Beverly Jenkins is like this amazing, you know, somebody actually. I really hope someone's done a PhD because, you know, she sold so much, and then you're looking at, and then you look back and you think, why weren't they scooping up other black historical romance authors when she was selling and selling and selling? And why was nobody going, this is a trend? This is a trend that we can cash in on. And they did. They Highlander it. They say there can be only one. Oh, well, better be Jenkins.
Right.
You know.
Right.
And then, of course, it tips. And then suddenly they go, oh, my God, Gold Rush. And then, you know, but then they're scooping up everyone they possibly can. Because finally they have worked out they can make some money on it, which obviously, as we know, is the publisher's sole reason for being. And it's slightly... It's maddening to observe. In my experience, with especially, you know, queer fantasy historical romance, was pretty much that all my guess, rather, is there's a whole bunch of people writing it and a whole bunch of publishers just going, no, that's not going to sell. That's not sell. Stampaign told me it wasn't going to sell, even while they published it as presumably an act of charity or something. And then, oh my God, it's sold. Right, now we'll think we're up all the manuscripts that I will absolutely bet you people have been sending in for years and years.
Sure.
Right. And what's fascinating about that is Samhain is one of those publishers. So let's talk about that piece of romance history, because it was so fleeting, it feels like. And
it was.
And it was so important at the same time, because there was this moment, this crest of a moment where ebooks had just hit. People had just started accepting, you know, e-readers as into their lives. There were so many of these small presses that were, you know, taking on authors who larger publishers were saying, nobody buys that, that there's no market for it. Samhain was one. Alora's Cave was doing it in erotica. There were a number of other queer presses. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit. We've never had anybody on who published with Samhain. So I wonder if you could talk a little about that world, who it was there, what was going on in the Samhain world. And then, you know, that didn't last for very long.
It didn't last for very long. It was very, very unstable. You look at that, they've all imploded, haven't they?
All of them.
You had Torquay, that's gone.
Except for Radcliffe's, but it's different because Bold Strokes is like Radcliffe running the show, right?
Yeah, no, Bold Strokes, I think there's a couple of ones where it's basically people who publish themselves and possibly their friends, and it's very, very specific. But also, lesbian romance kind of is differently siloed. So, you know, but for the sort of more general thing that was going on that I was part of, so you had Torquay that was, I mean, they were doing some really weird things with covers that were very difficult, and I think it ended poorly. And then Samhain, who were really sort of, they did a lot of exciting stuff, and they really put a lot of heart into it, ended poorly. And then you've got, you know, Dream Spinner, who are still going,
but don't pay their authors.
But don't pay their authors, and I, you know, have very strong views on
my
that.
My constant asterisk about Dream Spinner. They don't pay their authors, don't publish with them.
They do not publish with them because they still owe large amounts of back royalties they should never have touched. And then you have Riptide, who imploded in such a spectacular way that there was a whole page article about it in The Guardian, which is a UK newspaper about a small American press going under because of the spectacular nature of their implosion.
Well, it was so horrifying that.
It was horrifying. And, you know, I was one of the people who I had a book coming out with them, and I yanked literally that time. And, you know, it was one of those ones where it was so close to publishing, and, you know, I didn't want to publish with them, but it was like a couple of days before and there was an audio book. So I basically wrote to them and said, you know, I'm very dubious about this. And they literally reverted my rights without me asking, because I think they were just automatically
They were just doing it.
For everybody listening, we'll put a link in show notes to the Riptide story, but essentially, sort of very broad strokes, there was there were allegations of, and, you know, screenshots of an editor sexually harassing authors.
Yeah, there was a bunch more to it. There was another scandal. And anyway, the whole without delving any further into that, because to be honest,
we'll never get back out.
No, and I don't. It's not what today is about. So.
But pulling my hair out. But that was actually quite a large part of it. It was a very labile time. It was you know, there was a great deal of hope, a great deal of people who were in some ways throwing everything at the wall to see what would stick, because nobody knew, because nobody had been doing it before.
Right. It literally hadn't existed.
Suddenly, yeah, queer presses had been, you know, these very tiny outfits probably operating out of New York and, you know, doing a paperback for like $20 or something because of the cost. And suddenly you can whack it out there and get it on ebook. And, you know, the numbers were pretty startling, because so many people were around the whole world who had been unable to get these books were able to get these books. But of course, what happened, and which happened with much of romance, is, you know, the realization that you could then self-publish on Amazon and get 70% instead of 25%. And people started questioning what a lot of those presses, you know, you search at Talkair and they put an absolutely shocking generic cover on it and didn't give you any editorial support. Or, you know, you get your mates to knock up a cover and put it on Amazon. And, you know, wasn't really a debate. So I think that's that very heavily lies behind why so many of them didn't survive.
I just was doing a library thing and I was talking about, like, a lot of people who self-publish will, like, kind of trade services with each other as a way to, like, get books to market, right? Like, as you said, like, I have a friend who can do a cover and I can do a copy edit and, right? I mean, it feels like, even though it's there, it feels like people are, like, recreating the work of the publisher, like, in smaller groups in order to put out good products.
That does exist. I definitely know of people who do it, and there's a lot of sort of horse trading with newsletters and, you know, mutual supports and so on and so forth, which I think, yeah, can be great. I'm always a bit dubious about putting the words community and authors in the same sentence, because the words cats in a sack can also. But, you know, there are clearly people who do work together to help one another and, you know, and recommend. And, you know, there's lots of people who will just email me or DM me and sort of say, can you help with this? Can you tell me somebody who might?
Yeah.
Who did you use for? And I think that's, yeah, that is important. For any marginalized community, but especially when you're trying to build it.
This week's episode of Faded Mates is sponsored by Lumi Labs, creators of microdose gummies. So you've all heard us talking about microdosing and the concept of microdosing, which is commonly associated with psychedelics, wellness, performance enhancement, and creativity. And we've been talking about microdose gummies for a while on the podcast, and we've talked a lot about how we use them ourselves. Jen uses them for sleep. I have used them in the last few months as sort of a way to just take the edge off and, like, come down off of a rough time or a stressful time over the holidays. People use them for creative boosts. We've heard about people who listen using them for pain and anxiety.
It's a great product that's going to fit into your lifestyle, right? So I was like, the whole idea of, like, just chilling out in this really stressful time of year has been one way lately that I have found them helping me.
Yeah. So if you search around the internet, have a Google search on microdosing, you'll learn more. And you'll learn about all the ways that people are using them out there in the world. Our show today is sponsored by Microdose Gummies, which deliver the perfect entry-level doses of THC that help you feel just the right amount of good. And you can find Microdose available nationwide. It'll be shipped directly to your doors at microdose.com. You can use the code FADEDMATES for 30% off your first order and free shipping. Thanks, as always, to Lumi Labs and Microdose for sponsoring the episode. Did you have a community coming up? Cats in your sack?
I'm not a very good community person. Tend to be fairly, there's a reason I work on my own in the shade. But, you know, I've had,
editors or anybody who you felt was, like, helping you to sort of shape the road.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, there's really, it was also like, I've talked a lot with Alexis Hall, obviously queer, romance, British. That's been really, really interesting. Jordan Hawke, who I co-wrote a book with, and E. Osterman as well. And that's actually been really important, I think. Partly I talk to Brits because it is actually a bit separate. Yeah, romance is so American dominated that it's actually, you know, nice. So, you know, Talia Hibbert, for example, who was great, and Alexis. And I've also got, you know, that Mae Peterson, who is an author of mostly trans, also non-binary romance, including fantasy romance, but who's also a really good editor and a book doctor. And she's, like, book doctored 3 books for me and, you know, saved them effectively. So, you know, having someone like that at your back is absolutely invaluable. Yeah, I think, you know, establishing relationships just with people who will actually give your book a read and tell you to, you know, calm down and take a deep breath if you're being given hassle is very important to do.
Do you think the perception of romance has changed over your career? I mean, coming up from like Mills and Boone to where we are now, like kind of how has it changed in like any, do you have a crystal ball? Like, where are we going?
The problem is, you know, how do people see romance and all that? It's, you know, it's such a massive genre that it's really hard. Like, you know, I see people say things about romance and I'm thinking, yeah, but you're looking at like Kindle Unlimited that's full of font books and, you know, toxic, I don't know what, my God, the hell people are doing in there. And then you're looking at the kind of books which are, a lot of the kind of books which are getting on the shelves at the moment, which there's much more diversity and there's a much stronger sense of, sex positivity and body positivity and all these great things. And then, you know, you've also got this huge strand of, there's always a 50 Shades or a Colleen Hoover, isn't there?
Right.
And
yes.
And, you know, how can we say, what do people think of romance when you're simultaneously talking about Tamia Hibbert and Colleen Hoover and whatever godforsaken thing is at the top of the Kindle Unlimited charts? You know, I have different perceptions of those things. So the thing that actually is really striking me at the moment, so you're getting a lot more romance of the kind that I like and read is hitting the bookshelves, you know, Boyfriend Material and Red, White and Blue and, you know, Talia Again and, people like Jackie Lau, who's, you know, set out to write romance with Chinese leads because she couldn't get them published. And she just sort of doggedly said, right, I'm going to self-publish these because no publisher will take them. And now she's got it, you know, now she's being traditionally published because, you know, she just dug in and did it. So you're getting all those on the shelves. But I don't know if it's the same in the US, but I went into the Waterstones, the only big book chain we've got left, and there's a table covered in romance novels, and the label on it says new adult. Doesn't say romance anywhere. The word romance doesn't come up.
No, they don't like that word. No.
Yeah.
No.
Well,
no.
You know,
TikTok.
What the hell? Yeah. Well, I mean, do not give me, those are not new adult books. That's complete rubbish. But they don't, you know, and this is why the cartoon covers bothers me, not because I don't like them aesthetically, but because it seems to me part of the big branding effort to go, this isn't romance. You know, it looks like chick lit or it looks like lit fic. I mean, there's a book that's come out recently whose name, I probably shouldn't say, but it's okay because I can't remember it. but it's got, the blurb is one of those, looks like it belongs on Kindle Unlimited. It's one of those ones of, he looks at me with his dark eyes and I see myself falling into the prison of his yada, yada, yada. Like blank verse, you know, there's blank verse.
So, and there's no names. And it's so frustrating when you're trying to get information.
There's no names. And it's just all this sort of vague, she is my doom, she is my destiny, et cetera. So the blurb is all that. But the cover really is this absolutely beautiful thing that looks like it belongs on like a book about a Hungarian countess in the 1940s who's like, whose family is slowly decaying during the war, you know.
She's trying to keep that castle together. It's hard work.
It's the most lit fic cover you've ever seen. And the blurb is the most horrible KU thing you've ever seen. And the book, I have no idea what the book is.
Yeah,
you know, I completely don't know what
is in there.
Absolutely clashing. I don't know.
Maybe that's the strategy.
Well, if the strategy is to confuse anyone who knows anything about romance, then they have absolutely nailed it.
I saw a book the other day that is absolutely not romance, just like contemporary fiction. And it had a very kind of generically vector art cover. And I just thought, this is not a romance-only problem now, right? This is a publishing problem.
Like, it is
it's
a massive
just all one
problem.
Big bin to them, I guess. It's a book.
The last two romantic comedies I have bought, both of which had cartoon covers and, or, you know, drawn covers, and
were they
both
funny?
Of which said rom-com on the blurb, neither of them has been a romance, and actually neither of them was a comedy.
Yeah.
And one of them was all about, like, the heroine was being stalked by her toxic abusive ex. That's not comedy. Why is that funny? What's going on here? And there's no romance. It's the other one. It's a very good book, but it's literally a book about this woman having this really difficult relationship with her family and her faith and whatever. And she gets engaged to this other guy. And then at the end, she thinks she might start dating the one that the other guy who's like really nice. You know, I think I might start dating him in a couple of months. It's not a happy ending. You can't call that a romantic comedy, but they are.
Right.
Yeah. So where do I think romance is going? I, you know, if the publishers are in charge, I
down really right,
not right up. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I feel that way, right? Like they're like, it would be great if this would just go away. Can we just make money off of you without giving you what you want? That's what we would like.
It's kind of baffling to me because, you know, my experience as an editor was very much simply that publishers will do basically anything for money. And I don't understand why it's an asterisk exception romance. You know, I mean, especially the Mills have been, yeah, they were such a good publisher to work for in a lot of ways, and they were completely lent into what they were doing. They were like, we had an internet forum where readers were encouraged to come on and talk to editors. We were literally so encouraged fun. At work to sit there and chat with readers on the forums. That was a part of my job. I got paid for that. And it's amazing. but, you know, they were groundbreaking and things like that.
Well, it is interesting that you bring that up because it feels like those publisher, again, when you, so you were editing for Mills and Moon in the 90s? No.
Yeah, it's got to be 20 years ago. Yeah.
So at that time, there were so few places for readers to find.
Yeah, right.
Authors and publishers. And romance has always felt to me like the community of romance readers is so active and so eager to romance readers are so eager to find each other because I think of the perception from the outside world that we're all like cat ladies or sex crazed. Like it's one or the other, right? And there's
both and listen, stop judging me.
And so the idea being that, you know, because the outside world has this really negative perception of us as readers, when we find each other, we are so grateful to find each other. And the interaction, I think, I mean, speaking to my friends and people, colleagues who write outside of romance, their relationship with readers is incredibly different than my relationship with readers. And I think that is something that's very special to romance. And so I'm sort of curious about how that world has shifted in your perception, because I remember before I was writing, Avon was doing similar things. Like there were boards, you know, Tessa Dare and Cordy Milan and others came up through the Avon boards as, you know, they were writing Bridgerton fanfic essentially on the Avon boards.
Yeah.
And then Avon, you know, had a fanlit contest where Julia Quinn judged the finals.
Yeah. I mean, that kind of thing was amazing. It was wonderful. I basically, you know, I would be talking to people. I remember giving the call to somebody who was a regular on the Mills and Boon boards. And, yeah, when we announced, it was wonderful because I got to do it in person. It was one of the best days of my life.
So
I told
fun.
Her in person. She burst into tears. We were at a conference. She burst into tears and she cried so hard that people were, like, rushing up thinking she'd had, like, news of her family's death.
She was like...
I love it when they cry. And then we announced it on the Harlequin boards and they just exploded,
yeah.
You know, the sheer joy. But it was also, you know, yeah, and I had done this because it was a great book and she was a great writer and I loved doing it. But, yeah, somebody described it as the best piece of PR Mills and Boone ever had. And it kind of was because all of those people literally saw in real time that one of them, it could happen to you.
Yeah.
It did happen to her,
right.
You know.
Exactly.
And it was joyous. That's absolutely joyous.
And now I feel like the readership is finding us in so many different ways, right? Like there's a constant sense of them being able to touch us on Twitter, on Goodreads, on, you know, in all these different places. And I wonder if that's changed the way you think about writing. I often wonder that about myself. Like, do I write differently because I'm interacting so much with readers? And this is a different question from the one that's going around on Twitter right now, which is, are reviews, what's
well,
the purpose
no,
of
no,
reviews?
Right,
I don't want to talk about that.
No.
I do think a lot about readers when I write.
Well, you can't not.
But I think a lot of writers don't at all. Jen and I have talked to, you know, however many. And there are so many who are like, I don't think about them at all. I write for myself. And that I'm not, I want to say for everyone out there, that's not me being, I'm not judging that. Like that's a,
no, it's,
that's
it's,
a way.
It's an approach.
Yeah.
I totally get it because I know people who just, you know, they don't want anything to do with social
head
media.
Down.
It's a time suck. Yep. And I get people who say, you know, I couldn't write, you know, I don't write my committee. I don't write my committee. I don't have, it's one of the reasons I'm so firm on the reviews for readers. I'm not sitting here finding out what Blob 27 wants to say about it. I don't care.
Right. Your mental health, I don't know how people survive that. Yeah. But yeah.
No, I have absolutely, you know, it's not a committee.
Uh-huh.
Okay, it's a benevolent dictatorship.
Sometimes not even benevolent.
No, it's a benevolent dictatorship, let's be real. And yet, I have learned so much from readers' comments and really insightful things, you know, which are not for me, but they are things that I have seen because they scroll past on my timeline. And when you see someone who is like really putting the work in to say, okay, here's this historical romance and this is why, you know, this was a misstep and this hit really badly and this hurt really badly. And you think, yeah, that is a misstep and it's potentially a misstep I could very easily have made. And I'm really glad I didn't make it and I don't want to make it. And I don't, and you know, the world is full of missteps I could make. I feel like it's, on the one hand, you could paralyze yourself. And on the other hand, you know, I would rather not hurt somebody than hurt them. You know, I don't want to hurt anyone. I don't want to say something stupid and crass if I can avoid it. I often say stupid, crass things, but I'd rather not. So I guess it's a fine line, isn't it?
I think strictly from a reader point of view, one of the ways I think romance has changed is that, I mean, like I grew up in a time of like, I hid my romance novels, right? I think a lot of us did. Or I didn't have a community of romance readers because I grew up in a time where there was like, how was I going to find those people?
Right.
And so I do think one of the ways like that romance has changed is that romance readers are no longer buying into the narrative of this is something we should be ashamed of. And I often wonder if that doesn't like trickle out in ways that say, as you've said, like, right, like this hurt me and I don't come to romance to be hurt.
No,
like there is an avenue for that to be heard, not like in a personal way, like this book isn't good, but in a, right? And I do think that maybe that's what Sarah's talking about. Like writ large, like you're more in touch with readers in a way, like we didn't have that. I mean, if you've been around long enough, you knew that this was like a secret shame. You sculpted down like the like library aisle or the bookstore aisle and got your books or you got them sent to your house. There's a reason there's not a like send the thrillers to your house package.
Yeah.
Right? Nobody needs that. Right? And
yeah.
I just think a lot about
science.
The reader is more, we're more aware of the reader because readers are more aware of ourselves. I don't know.
I think that's true.
But I also think people in general have just developed a much stronger idea that they can talk to creators and be talked back. I mean, you just look at, you know, that sort of powerful genre of memes where you've got some absolute idiot explaining to the creator of a TV show what the TV show is about.
Right.
But I mean, so I think, you know, the Twitter has almost, you know, given people this wild idea possibility that, you know, you can talk to your favorite author and they might interact with you and you say anything to them. And yeah, quite often people will at me and I will reply and then I'll go, I didn't think you'd reply, but you literally talked to me.
I'm not rude.
I'm British.
Yeah, I mean one day you might like talk to that person and have a podcast with them. It's crazy.
But I mean, this is not a binding guarantee that I will reply if someone asks me on Twitter.
Oh my god!
But I think the possibility of being sucked into the world of that is immensely strong, and especially if you don't have a fairly strong sense of self and a fairly, you need a tough hide for that kind of thing. I think if you're the kind of, you know, person who's always looking for feedback and who's devastated by a 3-star review or whatever, my only recommendation would be to stay the hell off social media altogether because it'll kill you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that is unfortunately just the way it is.
Are there books of yours that are like fan favorites? Like, are there books that you hear about from your readers more than others?
I mean, we obviously have our favorites here at Fate of Mace, but
Yeah, there are. I mean, you know, the Magpie trilogy, which is my first one. So obviously, they've been out the longest, but they also seem to have a place in my reader's hearts that nothing will match.
It's always those first ones. And you're I've written so many others.
I've got so many. I've got more translations of those than anything else. It's in now 8 languages, which is nice. And, you know, tattoos, when people get tattoos, it's usually Magpie Lord tattoos. Oh, the first tattoo is really terrifying. So nice. Yeah. It's amazing. It's just
all the more reason for you to be worried about Twitter, because then you're afraid, oh God, I'm gonna say something someday. And then these people have tattoos of our books.
My only tattoo is of a James Joyce quote, and he's not alive to really appreciate that about me. So
yeah, but you know, also he's not gonna get cancelled, then he'll feel dreadful. You have to strike it out and go cancelled up. Yes.
Be like, God damn it.
I think it's incredible. I see that, and I still just sit there in like your gobsmacked awe that this thing could possibly be happening.
Amazing.
Someone could react like that. But yeah, so no, people, I think those are the ones that strike. Although, well, in fairness, there's 3 books in the trilogy, and then there's 2 books in the extended world. So also, I think people have a real opportunity to take a deep dive and roll around in the world, which is nice.
So to the same extent, or a similar question, but from the other side, is there a book that you've written that you feel is the one? This is the one that, you know, 50 years from now, this is the K.J. Charles book I wish everyone would
read. When we talk about you, the way people talk about Georgette Heyer, we're like, this was the good one.
Oh, gosh, that's such a hard one, isn't it? Most of them have different things that I'm proud of. I mean, look, if you're asking me sort of which book am I proudest of, it's probably book 3 of my Will Darling series, solely because there was literally no way I was able to write that book, because I published book 1 just at the start of the pandemic, and I had just finished writing book 2 when I was publishing 1, because it was, you know, it's self-pub and you can do that. And book 3, I'm trying to write it in the pandemic. Plus, it's a book 3 of the same couple trilogy, and I put all that work in. And I couldn't do the plot at all. It was really plotty, and there was a and I couldn't decide on the. I mean, you know what it was like writing in the pandemic. Flipping heck. But you know, it had a murder mystery, and I wrote the beginning with the same character. First, he was the victim, and then he was the murderer, and then he was the key witness. And, you know, I had to write this over and over again, and I just couldn't write this bloody book. And in
the plot is the worst.
It took me 10 months. And, you know, I cannot normally write a book in 4 months. It took me 10 months to write this. I had to stop and write a different book in the middle just to take my mind off things. So the fact that I finished it, and the fact that lots of people, you know, some people sort of would, it's been reviewed as, you know, her best book kind of thing. I think, I will eternally be proud I did that. I'm also actually incredibly proud of The Secret Lives of Country Gentlemen, which is one that is coming out in March with Sourcebooks, because that
is tremendous, everyone. I was very lucky to be able to read it early.
Well, I'm proud of it as a book, but I'm also immensely proud because, I've published with Sam Hain, and then I had 6 books with Love Swept, which were only published in E, which is an experience so phenomenally rancid that in 2017 I basically switched to self-publishing and decided I didn't want anything to do with publishers ever again as long as I lived. And while, you know, started looking to change that a few years later, but so Secret Lives of Country Gentlemen is now my first book that is coming out primarily in print. Sourcebooks is obviously coming out in E, but Sourcebooks is print-led. Yeah, you know, it's going to be on bookshelves, it's being promoted, it's had reviews in all the big journals, which is not something you get when you're self-published as a rule.
Right.
And it is actually out there going, look, there is Queer Historical is on the shelves to buy, being promoted by a publisher, and, you know, being part of, you know, a tiny part, but a part of that wave of getting some representation out there. So I'm just hugely proud of that.
Everyone, you can pre-order it now. So one last question that we really like, because we feel like the history of romance is so unwritten. So, and we sort of mentioned this earlier, but when you think about like the people that you've worked with that maybe are not like the unsung heroes of romance, right? Are there people you worked with at Mills and Boon or people that you've worked with even as you self-published or at Samhain? Like the we like to put the names in show notes just so that like they show up in Google searches. And, you know, these are people that we can sort of say like, hey, these people were an important part of making romance happen.
Oh, it's hard, isn't it, to sort of define.
It's like giving an Oscar speech. Just get in the mood, guys.
I mean, okay, so some of the authors I would think of, and I've named some of them before, but the people who have just dug in and written the books about, written the books that publishers weren't taking. So again, Jordan L. Hawke and E. Osterman, who are writing trans romance, and Jackie Lau and Talia Hibbert, who are writing, diverse romance, and have driven through and become, really successful. And then you've got like the authors of trans romance who are getting published now because that's happening in Carina. So you've got like Penny Ames and Chris Ripper and Mae Peterson and who are, leading the charge and pushing forwards. And, I want them to explode. Not literally, I want their books to fail really well. And actually also, the people, because, Mills has been for a long time, Harlequin, certainly when I came into romance, very white, basically. It was pretty much very, very heavily white when I was there as an editor. And then you've got people like Therese Bahari and Jadisola James, Jeannie Lynn was with them. People who were actually getting in there and changing things and, being very visibly... writing books about the print is an actual Nigerian print, not the kind you send emails, but your actual Nigerian print. Therese Bahari writes, she's a Black South African and she writes, books. And she's also moving to traditional publishing category. But all those people, they fought so hard to be seen. And, I want them all to be huge successes because they're also all wonderful writers. So that matters. And then in terms of editors, the one who actually really leaps to mind, I wish I knew what she was doing now, is Anne Scott, who was my editor at Samhain. And I say this because she gave me the single best piece of editorial advice I had ever received in my life. And one which I still think about and still becomes relevant every time I write a book because I keep doing the same thing over and over again. But she basically just... highlighted passage and said, "This reads like you're explaining the plot to yourself, and I've never been so seen in my life." I know, I can see your face there, Rab. Yeah, exactly. But
but also, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I'm like, I'm gonna write that down. That's a good thing to tell people.
Man, that happens in every book.
But to have an editor who will actually just sit there and say that to you, and it's just genuinely every manuscript. I'm, why is this so? Period. Yeah. Why is this whole passage so slow and boring? Oh, right. I'm doing it again.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm recapping for myself because I took a little break.
Yeah, exactly. It's shockingly easy to do. But, when you get that kind of maxim, you will never forget it. And I actually, I did a book called The Secret Casebook of Simon Vexamore, which is framed as the hero is a kind of Watson who writes stories about his lover who he works with and is framed as a letter to the editor. And I actually named the editor Henry Scott after Anne Scott because, she just deserved to be immortalized. But that kind of thing, you just can't forget.
That's a great piece of advice. That's great advice.
We did a deep dive read along of Van Sinister. So hopefully all of our readers have read a K.J. Charles book. But if they haven't, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what makes a K.J. Charles book. Because you've written all over the place in terms of there's magic sometimes, there isn't magic, sometimes there's more romance, sometimes there's a murder, sometimes there's three books with the same couple. So I wonder, is there something that when you think about yourself and the way you write that you always get from K.J. Charles?
I have basically two taglines, sort of taglines, which have been bestowed on me. And one of them is romance with body counts, which is completely fair. Somebody did an infographic of deaths in my books, and it's just horrifying.
I'm
going to
find
this
that.
This was sort of 17. This one, and then like the different animals that people have been killed by and that kind of thing. So, Romance with Body Count, High Murder Levels, definitely. And the other one is Heya But Gayer, which just sums up everything I... It sums up everything I aspire to.
Oh my gosh, put it on your tombstone.
Oh, totally.
Listen, so, tattoo worthy, I'll say it.
Van Sinister is absolutely Heya But Gayer, and The Will Darling Adventures is Romance with Body Count kind of thing. So those sort of sum up the kind of things I write, albeit over different time periods. But if I had to identify one element that was most present, it is probably the theme of a lonely person finding an alliance, friendships, loyalty, yeah, not just from their loved one, but in a larger group.
That's the right answer.
And I totted it up because, you know, when I looked at your thing before, and as far as I can tell, out of approximately 27 books so far, 23 have this as a theme. So that's quite a lot. But it's so important because, you know, you've got, especially, I'm writing historicals about a time where there was no social safety net whatsoever. And, you know, if you didn't have a supportive family or a supportive community, you know, you were in so much trouble. And B, you know, I'm writing about queer people who are, you know, take that, what I just said, and multiply it by a factor of about 50. And it seems to me that a happy ending very often requires, you know, it takes a village, fundamentally. So I seem to have a drive to give people their best friends and the new best friends and their group and the place where they feel at home. And it's not just with one person. It's got to be bigger than that. So I think that would be me.
We'll think about how to make that into something catchy like Heya But Gayer. Not sure I'm up to the task, but that, you know, then you'd have like three: Romance with a Body Count, Heya But Gayer, and like, I'll keep working on it.
But I did a series called Society of Gentlemen, set in, it's a very realistic type Regency world in that it's politics like cats in a sack and people like being informed on and sent to prison for their political views and revolution and so on. And one of the heroes is a seditionist, and one of the things he repeats throughout the book is, "I don't inform." You know, it's his catchphrase. He does not inform. It doesn't matter what you do to him, he's going to be absolutely loyal to his friends. So
that's a seditious affair, right?
That's a seditious affair.
Yes. My favorite of that series.
Yeah, I enjoyed writing that so much.
Silas and Dominic in there. Perfect and always.
I really enjoyed writing that one because it's got a lot of the things that I write about a lot, like, yeah, class difference, which is absolutely huge there, and money difference, but also, you know, what to do when you've got genuinely opposing points of view. Because I really feel that most of the time, a conflict isn't there's one person who's right and one person who's wrong. It's there's people who came at it from a completely different point of view and have to reconcile those points of view. And, you know, one of them going, "I'm sorry, I was totally wrong," isn't, you know, it's easier.
Not kind of how that
but
works.
But it's not how it works. Yeah. So, so I'm very proud of that one.
We are pro-conflict here at Faded Mates, so
on the record. KJ, this was wonderful. Thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
And talking about your life and romance and your thoughts. I love every time you write a long form piece about what's wrong with writing and romance.
Well, and I will say, I mean, we didn't mention it, but KJ's blog is if you want to write romance and you are not reading it, you are doing it wrong. And as an editor, if you are an editor and not giving people, like, I'm often like, read this, because it's so great. I mean, that's the thing. I feel like your editor's eye, you can see in the things that you write yourself, but also in the way that you talk about books you've read. We're lucky to have you.
Well, I really scratched my itch because I miss being an editor. I loved being an editor. And if they would only pay me enough, I would still be an editor. But, you know, it's the way I scratch my itch to, like, talk authoritatively about books these days is in large part by blogging. And plus, I also find that if I blog on a subject that I'm sort of noodling about in my own writing, I often find, my granddad used to say, "How do I know what I think till I hear what I say?" And I feel that maybe what I'm doing.
That's perfect. No, we do that too. I feel like whenever I'm in deep in a book, I'm like, "Jen, can we do an interstitial about this thing that I'm working on?"
So yeah, exactly.
I can read a bunch of books and then
noodle it. So yeah, and you talk about it, but you're not talking about yourself. You're just talking about the problem abstractly. And lo and behold, it turns out that
yeah,
you know,
right. That's what I did. Solution appears.
That's what I think. Thank God, I knew it was something.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. What an amazing conversation. And we wish you the best of luck with The Secret Lives of Country Gentlemen, which is, as I said, tremendous.
Thank you.
And you should all go read it immediately. I had a whole lot of joy reading it. March 7th.
March 7th.
Thanks, KJ. Excellent.
Well, thank you very much for having me. That was lovely.
What a delight.
Oh, she's the greatest.
She's so fun.
Yeah. Yeah. So during the pandemic, Joanna Shoup has a Facebook group, if you love historical romance.
The League of Extraordinary Historical Romance Writers.
And readers can be in that space too, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a really fun group. And during the pandemic, I hosted a bunch of like kind of Zoom chats, right? Like, remember how desperate we were to just like, you know, talk about things. And KJ was on once and I was like, oh, wow, this is great. And so one of the things, can we talk about her like working at Mills and Boone stories? So awesome.
I know. And so one of the things that I just realized before we started recording the, you know, the intro and the outro for this episode is we didn't say this, but I'm sure most of you know that Mills and Boone is Harlequin.
Right.
It's just called Mills and Boone in the UK, Australia, Canada. Although I think now in Canada it's Harlequin. I don't know. Don't quote me on that. But Mills and Boone and Harlequin are crossover publishers. So presents that are published by Mills and Boone can be published by Harlequin, etc. I was really fat. I wish I'd thought to push her more on talking more about medicals. Because
yeah.
I would really like to know why medicals aren't
an American thing.
Don't
yeah.
really sell over here. Because I love a doctor, as you know.
I really honestly do feel like it maybe, I joked about ER, but I do think that maybe it's a different, like, I think maybe American TV has trained us to expect a different kind of medical thing happening.
See, you know what I immediately thought of? Was like, does it have something to do with insurance?
Well, sure. I mean,
because
yeah, nothing.
Medical
yeah.
issues are so much more stressful for Americans than they are for people in all the rest of the world.
Right.
Because we have to worry about costs.
Yeah. Maybe.
But I don't know, that just went to a bleak place. Anyway, I get universal healthcare, everybody. Vote for politicians who want to give you healthcare.
A whole new romance world will open up to us.
Imagine if that happened, if we got universal healthcare and an entire new world of contemporary romance.
What a world.
Listen, that's what they should do. They should put out commercials like that in election season.
Yeah. I think the thing that I also, when I think of, I love KJ Charles's books. Obviously, we talked about Band Sinister is my favorite, but there are writers who have like different strengths, right? And one of the things about KJ Charles's books is like they are impeccably plotted and the pacing is perfect. And all of the like emotional beats, like, right? Like KJ Charles, as we like to say, like really knows the job. And so it was really fascinating to hear her talk about like learning, the neural pathways, like literally being retrained, right?
Yeah. Spending years editing.
Yeah.
Category has to hone that skill better than really anything else, I would think.
Absolutely.
There's just no, I mean, I talked about this when we did the Band Sinister episode, but there's nothing extra in those books. Every yeah. word is placed intentionally. Every plot point is intentional. I was really fascinated. I was truly incredibly fascinated by her talking about Heyer and how
yes.
Heyer has really influenced her work. And that, of course, is because when we think about Heyer now, when we look back on it, Heyer's sort of a problematic antecedent, right?
Yeah.
And for all of us. And I think what was really interesting to me when she talks about Heyer is how much she acknowledged queer coding in Heyer.
Yes.
Which is not a thing I have ever thought about. I mean, obviously, when we talk about, you know, cross-dressing heroines and, you know, a lot of those things that were so essential to romance and continue to be really constant in historicals, it's never really given. I've never thought about them. I've thought about them coming from Hare, but I've never thought about them coming from Hare and being possibly intentionally queer coded in Hare.
Uh-huh.
And it made me think, gosh, I wish KJ would write the introductions to a bunch of these Hares. So if you're a publisher out there,
now you know who to talk
planning
to.
Planning to republish Hares.
Yeah.
Hit up KJ to write some of them, the introductions.
I think that this is something, and again, like, we are two straight ladies talking about this, so, you know, I don't want to, misstep, but I have thought a lot about what she was talking about. You know, these books have existed for a long time, but in small press runs and, you know, with Vincent Averga, like in specific bookstores, right? Like, knowing it, you know, so like how to get those books into your life was charged, right? And so I think a lot about how angry I am, right? That like people are realizing, oh, this is dangerous. And, you know, these movements to remove queer books, right? It doesn't have to be coded anymore.
We don't have to queer code anymore.
Right?
Although I think we are going to start seeing it.
I just can't get over, I don't know. I'm so upset about us going backwards. And I'm so upset about the kids who had to look for queer coding because queerness explicitly didn't exist. And it's just so wrong to be taking that back from young readers, from any readers.
Absolutely. I want to pause in our KJ discussion to just say to everyone, if you have not listened to our book banning episode, and I know like it, you know, there were lots of reasons why people maybe skipped that episode, but it is so important to hear the voices of those people who are being impacted directly by book banning. And so we have it. We'll put links in show notes to it. It sits now on the main page of fatedmates.net so that everybody can access it. But I encourage you to go listen to that episode so that you can, you know, get more informed about what is actually happening in the world right now, in the United States especially. I thought that was really interesting. I really thought I was interested in the way that the way she talks about historicals. You know, we talked about this too, that there are kind of two schools of historicals. You know, the historicals that are maybe more historical fantasy without magic, as she said.
Right.
And then what she writes, which is more historical romance, purely. And I think that she threaded a really interesting needle there. And I do think, like, there are really interesting things happening on both sides of that line.
Right. And I think I love historical. God, I love historical so much. And I feel like there's such refuge for me. And it sounds like for KJ too, in, you know, thinking about who we are now through the lens of who we were then. It's such a powerful way to sort of like think about the differences. And also, what I really loved is, I think one of the things you and I is like, romance is fun. Hey, like, romance is fun.
It should be fun.
It should be fun. And it doesn't always have to be fun. That's not the only mood that romance, you know, kind of can be in. But I really loved, because that's one of the things I think about KJ's books, is like, I have always, you are in for a good time reading those books.
They rollick.
Yes, exactly. And I think that that's part of it's nice to hear a author who is so committed to romance being fun talk about what that means and what that looks like and how you get there. And then to hear that readers respond to it is so powerful, right?
I think she wasn't giving herself enough credit when she talked about how readers interact with her text, because I think reading KJ's remarkable books with her communities of, you know, supportive communities of characters, and the way love is just so beautifully represented in all of these books. I mean, she just does it so, so well. She is one of the best of us, undeniably. And I think for readers, there is such power in that. And I imagine, you know, back in the day when Samhain was producing, you know, some of the only ebooks that you could find that were queer romance, KJ must have been incredibly transformational for a lot of readers.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot about it because one of the things I feel is sometimes romance authors develop secondary characters only as like bait for later books, right? And that is not, and look, God, trust me, I love it, but that is not what KJ Charles is doing, right?
Uh-uh.
I think it's really important in terms of like from a writing standpoint to really like state that, right? Like every single character in her books is there to be themselves, not there to just be like, you know, I'm here to support the other characters, or I'm here to be background, or I'm here for a future book. You know, I'm just like, and I really think that that's like a hallmark of her style to me is how well developed it all is, right? Like no one's there just for a reason. And I think it's, if you're interested as a writer yourself about how to do good secondary character work, you should be reading KJ Charles.
Oh, 1,000%. I mean, you should be reading KJ Charles for a lot of reasons. I mean, her incredible plotting.
Yes.
And you know, this sounds like you're explaining the plot to yourself. Is like,
oh,
yes, I felt harmed by that. But the truth is that her plotting is so clean. And it, I mean, I don't know if it happens on the first draft or if it happens later, but the way her plots come together is so tidy. And we talked about this. We're sort of rehashing the deep dive that we did. But hearing her talk about process in that way was really valuable. And I think also, you know, one of the things that she seemed to be able to do, she seems to have been able to do with her career, is really write all around. Like she, you really get the sense from her that, you know, as difficult as it has been in terms of the, it sounds like her publishing journey has been, you know, not great all the time. And certainly like losing your publisher closing, having a terrible relationship with your publishers, like can really impact what you end up writing. It sounds like for her, it has also been really, it has allowed her to really explore.
Is this the first like predominantly self-published author we've had on?
Well, we had E.E. Trailblazer.
Oh, and E.E. Ottman. And I mean, that's probably not a mistake, right? Because,
and Radcliffe. I mean, if you think about our queer.
Oh, yeah, right.
Our guests. Right. That, you know, with the exception of Vincent, but that's just because it didn't exist probably when Vincent.
Sure.
I mean, it definitely did not exist when Vincent was writing.
And I think that this is the thing where we haven't really, I think we are like agnostic. When we talk about books, we're just like, this is a good book. We're not really talking about like necessarily the pipeline that brought it to your Kindle or to your door.
Uh-huh.
I think that when we think about like this time in romance, right, like the ability to self-publish, right, like the gatekeeping that exists that then people can circumvent is going to bring us books like KJ Charles, like E.E. Ottman, like Mae Petersen, right? Like these are books that, and then because of the success of these authors, then we can see how traditional publishing is like, oh, there is a market for this, right? Like her, that whole discussion of like the ways publishing is like, well, if this sold already, we'd already be selling it, right? And I think that the only, in that way, self-publishing has been such a gift, not just to the queer romance community, but just to all readers, right? Like I can read books now that I didn't know I would love because publishing didn't think I would buy it. And I think that that part, talking about like the journey from traditional, like a kind of traditional independent publisher, Sam Hain, down to like the Riptide Dream Spinner, you know, this has been a circuitous route. And it's hard to see the, I don't know how to say this, right? Like the whole story until it's later.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that we're going to really look back and, I mean, self-publishing is, you know, it gives and it takes.
I mean, you and I come at romance, right? With a very a keen sense of we have to know the past in order to understand what's going on, right? I don't think everybody comes to romance that way, and I don't think everybody has to. But I think for you and me, there is a very real sense of the history informing the present, right?
Right.
And I think people like KJ teach us that. I mean, I just don't believe that I don't believe that indie publishing would be where it is if not for those small presses at the beginning. And I think that that is because those small presses, they rode that line between traditional publishing and the structure of traditional publishing and the timeline of traditional publishing and where we are now, right? And so I think that we are... I think we are very lucky to have had authors like KJ come up through those publishers, because I don't think that if we'd sort of immediately gone into what we are, where we are now with like a giant pool and everybody just throws their stuff into it, we would have the kind of discoverability that we do.
Well, and I think that this is also, you know, I'm thinking a lot about what she was talking about in terms of her readers, right? The letters she gets from readers. And everyone see her, right? But it was like, this is clearly something that moved her deeply. It moved me to like hear her talk about it. And I think that this is the part where, you know, what has in many seasons of Fated Mates, I hope what people really understand is like reading has made me who I am, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you're a reader, the things you read are changing, are making you who you are, realizing who you are, right? Like at all kinds of levels. And I just found it really beautiful to think that, you know, self-publishing, like cutting out those gatekeepers has just made room in the world for people who in romance, in the readership, in the world, like who they are. I don't know. I know this is... I just get on my, like, high horse about romance, how beautiful it is, how, like, much it means to me to know that, I don't know, there's nothing more important about, like, who you are in the world than, like, how you feel about yourself and who you are allowed to love, right?
Uh-huh.
I don't know.
And I just was, I was very moved by the idea that, like, people who have, you know, we've talked about, like, letters people, authors get from readers who are like, I don't like it when you swear, but you know what? Maybe that's worth it.
No, who cares about those letters in comparison to... Yeah. And I do think we are living in a really fascinating age of romance. And you and I talk about all the different ways that is true, right? And it's not all good, right? But the thing that is good is how easy it is to find yourself in the books now. I also think... We didn't say this with her, and I wish we had, because I do believe that she herself may be responsible for a lot of how historical romance is tackling queerness. Oh,
yeah.
And I mean that as, you know, the sheer difference between even the 90s and early 2000s and the way historicals would use queerness as a weapon. Right? Versus now, you do see queer characters in romance, in historical more. You don't see them as protagonists all the time, but you see them as secondary characters more, tertiary characters more.
Uh-huh.
And I think KJ is a big, big reason why. I think so many of us have looked to her books as, you know, remarkable texts and also a brilliant model for how to try to do this right.
Yeah. I mean, and I think that's why we wanted her on.
Uh-huh. Well, we're rethinking the way we think about trailblazers, right? Like we want very much to be collected. The theory of this batch of episodes, the series, is, you know, that we wanted to make sure we had a lot of these voices. And of course, like for us, we want to make sure we get the older voices as quickly as we can for lots of reasons. But that doesn't mean that but KJ is a perfect example of somebody who has transformed the genre.
Yes, right. as a reader, I it's funny because we've been talking, this is like not related necessarily to exactly to KJ Charles, but I had this moment this week where I was kind of like, what is it I value as a romance reader, a longtime romance reader, right? Like we see so many, new readers. It's really exciting for so many ways. But I have this moment where I just realized like what I really value is people who have a lot of interesting ideas, right? Uh-huh. I just like want to read your books if you have interesting ideas. And I joked about the book about the taxidermist because if you had told me that I would love a book about taxidermy, I don't think I would have believed you, right? And yet, obviously, it's just like a set piece in some ways, but her interests, I'm kind of glad I brought up to her talking about like how interested she became in it.
Uh-huh.
I think that that's the thing about KJ, when she said I have like 27 books or whatever it is, like they're not all the same.
They're
right?
Like not even close none to of the them. Same.
And I think that that's one of the reasons I think of her as one of my favorite authors is obviously she just does romance so well, but also she is always doing something interesting herself. I can see her challenging herself and that is challenging and exciting to me.
And what's fascinating is when she listed the authors who she thought were, important for us to name, almost all of those authors also do different things every time.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Like, right. Alexis Hall has never written the same book twice, right? So there's a fascinating, she is drawn to other authors who are doing, who are exploring.
Yeah. And that's the thing I feel like when I think about trailblazers to me, I mean, I think when we first started, it was kind of like you were the first, obviously these are the people who are like the first to do something or, on the, like riding the wave of being the first to do something. But I also think as like our thinking has changed, it's kind of like who is figured out a way to like write 27 books and keep it fresh, right? Who is figured out the way? And that is valuable to me. Because I think that's how we talk about, right? As she said, like, it's a huge, big tent, right? Romance is huge. So who are the people that are out there pushing on the corners?
Uh-huh.
I'm interested in how they just think about their work and what they do.
All right. Well, another trailblazer in the can, as they say. Everyone, this is Faded Mates. Don't forget, Faded Mates Live is March 24th in New York City. We would love to see you. Bring your friends. Tickets and more information at fadedmates.net/live. Next week, we've got an interstitial for you.
Yeah. I would like to just say quick shout out and thank you to Lumi Labs and Kylie Scott for sponsoring this week's episode.
We're thrilled to have you all. I'm Sarah McLean. I'm here with my friend Jen Prokop. You can find us every week at fadedmates.net, on Twitter at fadedmates, on Instagram at fadedmatespod. We will see you next week.